Superintendent Madeline Aguillard says kids can't thrive in these conditions.
They're not conducive for high expectations. They're not conducive for academic achievement. They're not conducive for athletic achievement.
It's not just sleep mute. Dozens of rural public schools in Alaska face similar problems, and the health risks are concerning. Long-term exposure to black mold can irritate lungs and cause chronic fatigue and neurological problems. Fungal spores from bat feces can also irritate lungs and cause blindness. Higher rates of health disparities among Alaska Natives have long been documented compared to the general population, and the majority of students in Alaska's rural public schools are Indigenous. Education Commissioner Dina Bishop acknowledges the public health concern, but says her agency isn't solely responsible.
If something's happening in the school, it's most likely happening in other buildings in the community. It is a collective Alaskan issue that we'd be happy to have a seat at the table to discuss.
Andrea John has three kids enrolled in Sleep Mute, and she says she thinks it's easy for the state to forget communities like hers.
Those city people, they wouldn't let their kids go to school here. They're choosing to look the other way instead of house us.
Emily Schwing reports for KYUK. A candlelight vigil is planned in Mesa, Arizona for Emily Pike, a Native American teenager who disappeared in January. She was staying at a group home in the city. Police recently confirmed some of her remains were discovered on a remote highway last month. Multiple agencies are now involved in the investigation, the Arizona Republic reports. Her family and the San Carlos Apache tribe, where she's from, are asking for privacy. American grasslands were once a mecca for biodiversity, but federal data shows more than 60% of the ecosystem has vanished due to agriculture, development, and invasive species. New research shows how the Mountain West region could play a role in the conservation of one important and yappy grassland animal. Rachel Cohen reports.
If you drive along a grassland, you might not see much. Anna Davidson says that's until you come across a colony of prairie dogs.
And as soon as you do, the life of the prairie is there.
Davidson is a scientist at Colorado State University. She says prairie dogs' underground burrows provide habitat for creatures from insects to ferrets. Her research team wanted to know the best spots to focus on their conservation, so they mapped intact native grasslands. But they also wanted to know where to avoid human conflict.
Is there oil and gas occurring there? Are there wind farms? Are there roads?
They found the highest potential for conservation efforts in the western portion of the grassland ecosystem. That includes less developed parts of Montana and Wyoming down to Colorado and northern New Mexico. I'm Rachel Cohen.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 6, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. A contributor for tonight's newscast is Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, taking Russia's side, the disastrous Trump-Zelensky meeting on February 28 exposed the new international reality that Ukraine and the rest of Europe faces, an historic U.S. retreat from European security and a turn to Russia. When J.D. Vance insisted at that meeting that the U.S. wants peace, Zelensky countered by reminding Vance of Vladimir Putin's failure to honor agreements. In other words, Ukraine wants a just peace, not peace at any price. That is Europe's demand as well. After a hastily arranged NATO summit on March 1st, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told the BBC that he, Zelensky, and President Emmanuel Macron of France had agreed that, quote, they would work on a plan for stopping the fighting and then discuss that plan with the U.S. Any peace agreement is going to need a U.S. backstop, Starmer added, saying that British and U.S. teams were discussing the idea. Starmer also said that after the summit, Europe would be increasing military spending and assembling a coalition of the willing to defend Ukraine. A number of countries will join Britain and France, he said, in providing troops to Ukraine once a ceasefire is agreed upon. So far, Trump has resisted the idea of a U.S. backstop. All he has wanted is Ukraine's minerals. Will he work with the Europeans, or is he content to be Putin's willing servant? The latter seems most likely. First, because Europe is now the enemy, and second, because Russia no longer is. On Europe, Donald Trump said at his first cabinet meeting, quote, the European Union was formed in order to screw the U.S. That's the purpose of it, and they've done a good job of it. But now I'm president. He promised 25% tariffs on EU exports to the U.S. very soon, which turned out to be Tuesday. And Trump believes the EU won't retaliate. They can't. I mean, they can try, but they can't. As for the Russians, the Trump administration has just taken two steps, and possibly a third, that take Russia out of the category of national security threat. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered the U.S. Cyber Command to halt offensive cyber operations and information operations against Russia, without getting any assurance from Russia that it would do the same. And The Guardian reports that an anonymous source says the Department of Homeland Security analysts have been verbally informed that they were not to follow or report on Russian threats, even though this had previously been a main focus for the agency. A third step in Russia's direction. The Commerce and Treasury Departments have been directed to draw up a list of sanctions on Russia's economy and individuals that might be lifted. The Russians are absolutely gleeful at this turn of events. The new administration is rapidly changing all foreign policy configurations, said Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov on state television. This largely aligns with our vision. Indeed, Trump's angry remarks directed at Zelensky were perfect fodder for Kremlin propagandists. Trump's warning about World War III, his insistence on peace talks with Russia but not with Ukraine, and his threat to withdraw the U.S. entirely from Ukraine's side fit with Putin's ideas. The Europeans are already stepping up with commitments to Ukraine. Britain announced a nearly $3 billion loan to Ukraine aimed at bolstering the war-torn country's military capability. It will be paid back using profits generated on sanctioned Russian sovereign assets, and the first tranche of funding is expected to be disbursed to Ukraine next week. Britain will also allow Ukraine to use about $2 billion from the British Export Financing Funds. And Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Union, announced that a high-level meeting will take place this week to fortify Ukraine with economic and military aid, with a goal of turning the country into a, quote, steel porcupine that is indigestible for potential invaders. Another loss for human rights in U.S. foreign policy. Throughout the course of Israeli strikes in Gaza, a small number of U.S. senators sought to gain the Biden administration's adherence to its own policy guideline, National Security Memorandum 20, which requires that allies, meaning Israel, do not use U.S.-supplied weapons in ways that violate human rights. Israel was doing just that, but Biden failed to follow through, which would have involved suspension of arms sales pending a State Department review. Now the Trump administration has rescinded National Security Memorandum 20 in an order by National Security Advisor Michael Waltz that has yet to be made public. Said Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, who initiated the attempts to bring Biden's memorandum in line with actual U.S. policy, quote, the rescission of NSM 20 is another clear example of Trump's blatant indifference to American values. This is not America first. It's America in retreat. Now the Trump administration has twice bypassed any congressional review of arms sales to Israel. The other day, Secretary of State Marco Rubio invoked emergency authorities to send Israel $2 billion in weapons, including those 2,000-pound bombs. The House and Senate committees that normally review such sales were bypassed. The decision came as Israel was declaring that no humanitarian or other assistance would be allowed into Gaza, which is my next item. So much for Rubio's supposed championing of human rights. The second phase of the Israel-Hamas agreement is on the rocks. Although the hostages for prisoners exchanges in the first phase of the agreement have now ended, moving on to the second phase has always been uncertain. Hamas is demanding to do so, which would mean a permanent ceasefire, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, and exchanges of the last hostages and prisoners. But Israel is insisting on continuation of the exchanges for 7 weeks to get all the hostages back. It has halted all aid deliveries, including food and fuel, into Gaza until Hamas agrees to the extension. Only water will be allowed in. The Israelis claim that the idea of an extension comes from Trump's special Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, who evidently sees no problem in interfering with the agreed-upon peace process on behalf of Israel. If an agreement cannot be reached, the ceasefire will end. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promises consequences. That probably means that Israel is prepared to resume military actions. According to the Times of Israel, quote, "The government is still prioritizing the dismantlement of Hamas's governing and military capabilities, believing that no alternative can be established in Gaza until the terror group has been defeated," according to a Western diplomat. However, that diplomat argues that this approach was misguided, asserting that planning and implementing an alternative to Hamas must happen simultaneously with the Israeli Defense Forces fighting against the group. Otherwise, said the diplomat, what you will have is indefinite Israeli occupation and Hamas insurgency. In other news, Thailand deports the Uyghurs. I've been following this story for several weeks. Whether or not Thailand would bend to China and deport 48 Uyghurs who had managed to escape from China. Magnus Fijesko, a specialist on the Uyghurs at Cornell University, writes, "This morning, on February 27, Thailand deported over 40 Uyghur refugees to China, despite a pending court hearing set for next month. This was simply set aside, and it was perhaps a ruse to begin with. The shameful deportation was done under the cover of night, in buses with blacked-out windows to prevent the press from seeing the prisoners. A Chinese plane flew them direct from Bangkok to Kashgar in the Uyghur region, where China's concentration camps now await them. Thailand has now violated both the UN Convention on Torture, which it signed, and the principle of non-refoulement against sending refugees in harm's way. Thailand's betrayal of human rights also overrides the Thai politicians and lawyers and others who tried to protest, arguing that refugees had suffered enough, languishing in Thai jails for over 10 years, with 5 dying, including 2 children. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, whose supposed advocacy of human rights does not extend to Ukraine and Russia, found Thailand's deporting of the Uyghurs something to protest about. China's official explanation is that the Uyghurs will be, quote, returned to normal life as soon as possible, after being dealt with according to the law. Actual meaning, they will be sent for re-education. Next, Japan's public is souring on foreign aid. In an apparent response to both economic conditions and Trump's dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Japanese public's support of foreign economic assistance has reduced to a decade-long low. A total of 18% said cooperation should be minimized or halted entirely, rising by about 2 points to a 10-year high. About half of those polled said aid should remain at current levels, and 25% said aid should be more actively pursued. That's about the same as the American public's attitude, which is trending downward, with barely half of those polled supporting foreign aid to some degree. The Kurdish resistance to Turkey may be coming to an end. Abdullah Öcalan, the imprisoned leader of a Kurdish militant group that has fought a decades-long insurgency against Turkey, issued a call from prison last week asking the movement he founded to lay down its arms and dissolve itself. Öcalan heads the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which has been at war with Turkey's government for decades. Öcalan's appeal remains to be tested. The PKK will presumably have to vote on it, and the Erdogan government may need to offer concessions to win Kurdish support in future elections. What effect the PKK's dissolution in Turkey will have on Kurdish fighters in Syria also remains to be seen. Trump and the military, a questionable relationship. Five former defense secretaries under both Democratic and Republican administrations, Lloyd Austin, Jim Mattis, Chuck Hagel, Leon Panetta, and William Perry, have made public a letter denouncing Trump for firing the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman and several other Pentagon officials. The letter urges Congress, quote, to hold Mr. Trump to account for these reckless actions and to exercise fully its constitutional oversight authority. Also fired were the head of the Navy, the Air Force Vice Chief of Staff, the three military service judge advocates. None of the firings had to do with war fighting, said the letter. The flip side of those firings is that Trump, contrary to reports, is not cutting the budget of the Pentagon. As In These Times reports, cuts in so-called non-lethal programs have been made in order to shift funds to Trump's priorities: border control, Asia-Pacific security arrangements directed at China, nuclear weapon modernization, and an Iron Dome missile defense that most analysts regard as ridiculous. In all, the Republicans' budget proposal actually calls for a $100 billion increase in the Pentagon's budget. In keeping with that report, Trump and Hegseth are further militarizing the border. Never mind that illegal immigration from Mexico has gone way down. There were 30,000 illegal crossings in January, the lowest level since 2020. Yet the Trump administration is determined to use U.S. soldiers to defend the border. Hegseth has ordered between 2,500 and 3,000 additional troops, plus armored attack vehicles, to bolster the U.S. Customs and Border Police. Those Stryker vehicles are normally used in combat, most recently in the Ukraine war. Why these new deployments? Is Trump trying to intimidate Mexico in line with his imposition of new tariffs? Or is he sending the message that he'll use the military to deal with domestic unrest? Canadians are fighting back. Everywhere you look, there are signs that Canadians are riled over Trump's tariffs and are prepared to fight back. At the popular level, there are boycotts of U.S. goods. And at the political level, we have politicians who are strongly nationalist, such as Ontario's Premier Doug Ford. He romped to a third consecutive landslide win in a snap election, which he called, he said, in order to win a mandate to fight a trade war with the United States. Donald Trump thinks he can break us, Ford said. He is underestimating the resilience of the Canadian people, the Canadian spirit. Make no mistake, Canada won't start a fight with the U.S., but you better believe we're ready to win one. Ford had gained notice when he tried to lobby Congress members not to support higher tariffs. Well, that ship has sailed. Israel's plan for Syria, keep it weak. Reuters reports that Israel is lobbying the United States to keep Syria weak and decentralized, including by letting Russia keep its military bases there to counter Turkey's growing influence in the country. Turkey's often fraught ties with Israel have come under severe strain during the Gaza war, and Israeli officials have told Washington that Syria's new Islamist rulers, who are backed by Turkey, pose a threat to Israel's borders. Israeli thinking, according to Reuters sources, is that a strong Syria, free of U.S. sanctions, could become a base for Hamas, with Turkey's support. Prime Minister Netanyahu has already said that Israel will not tolerate Syrian Islamists' control of its southern border. Following Assad's ouster, Israel carried out extensive airstrikes on Syrian military bases and moved forces into a UN-monitored demilitarized zone within Syria. Earlier this week, Israel struck military sites south of Damascus. Finally, two pieces of late-breaking news that add to the ways in which the Trump administration has leaned to Russia's side. First, he has ordered a pause on all aid to Ukraine. And second, the CIA will no longer share intelligence with Ukraine. Zelensky, caught between a rock and a hard place, now is willing to sign a minerals deal with Trump and support U.S.-Russia talks. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. From the way conservatives talk about the federal government, you might think it's an inefficient and wasteful entity that just keeps growing without restraint. Not so, says Algernon Austin, the director of the Race and Economic Justice Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with him about the importance of the federal workforce and the Trump administration's campaign to eliminate as many federal workers as it possibly can.
Federal workers and the idea of small government versus big government. The conservatives have been harping on that theme for a long time. I remember that was one of Ronald Reagan's big ideas. How do you suppose that idea that a country of, what is it now, 350 million people needs a somehow a small government? How are they able to succeed in convincing people of that?
Yeah, so I'm glad you go back to that, because people don't recognize when people see the figure that our government is actually much smaller today than when Trump was born. Many people are surprised because conservatives are always talking about quote unquote big government. But as you point out, you know, from the 1980s, if not earlier, they've been aggressively working to shrink government and succeeding. So when Trump was born, it was the federal government, the share of workers who worked in the federal government was about 4.5%. And today it's 1.5%. So we've seen a big reduction. And yes, that notion of a small government doesn't work for such a large country. And for a government that we place so many demands on, we require so many different services from. So we really should be thinking about good government, not small government or big government, but good government, a government that helps, that protects our well-being, that guards our health, that keeps us safe. And right now, because the federal government is too small, it is struggling to keep us safe, healthy, and to improve our well-being.
Do you think that what the conservatives have been trying to do is basically instill the idea in people that public sector bad, private sector good?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are a lot of reasons for that. But yes, there has been, you know, with this desire to shrink government, there has been, that has led conservatives to do very anti-government campaigning and messaging. And yes, we already have moved a considerable amount of government work into the private sector. And what a lot of analysts find is that that is actually more expensive than keeping it in the public sector, because public sector workers tend to earn less than similar workers in the private sector. So when they move jobs out of the government into the private sector, it becomes more expensive, there's less accountability. But of course, it's more profitable for the private companies. Well, it's profitable for the private companies that take over those contracts. And, you know, I suspect that many of them are donating to the very politicians who are, you know, being anti-government and who are pushing for moving government services into the private sector.
Is there evidence that the private sector doesn't get the job done as well?
I don't know whether they get a job done as well, but we do know that it is more expensive. So I am not aware of any analysis that's saying that they do it better or that they do it worse, but we do have data suggesting that it's more expensive. So
We have heard about the private prison system as being a little more nasty than
there are certain functions that can be very harmful in the private sector. I mean, my colleague Eileen Applebaum, you know, capitalism, especially contemporary American capitalism, is about short-term profits. And short-term profits can be, when you're just pursuing that, can be very harmful to people working in those establishments and to, for the society as a whole. You know, child labor, for example, can be profitable, but as a society, we reject it. And Eileen Applebaum has done work looking at the private equity moving into healthcare spaces, and for a while they were in like emergency rooms. And in the emergency room, they would, I won't get into all of the details, but when you're in an emergency room, you have to take what's offered to you. And because of that, you know, these companies were able to charge exorbitant prices, and there was little that you can do about it. And you certainly couldn't, you couldn't price shop when you are in the middle of having a heart attack, for example. But the companies made tremendous profits by taking advantage of people in their most vulnerable situation. But I don't think anyone in the American society would think that that's a good way to do healthcare, and that's an ethical business practice.
Do you think that one of the good things that could come out of all these layoffs of federal workers is that people will realize how vital it is to staff these agencies with enough workers, and that there'll be a kind of backlash?
I sincerely hope so. I hope that we get people, you know, I mentioned good government. I hope that we get people to really defend government. So the piece that I wrote, you know, I highlighted, unfortunately, that tragic airlines crash where the American Airlines jet crashed into that U.S. Army helicopter. But the Washington Post reported that there were only two air traffic controllers doing the work of four. You know, so we need everyone to recognize, oh, air traffic controllers, we should be adequately staffed. The National Air Traffic Controllers Association says 40% of their members are working 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. So they're overworked, they're stressed, they're fatigued. That is not good government. That is not healthy for the workers. That is not healthy for the people on the planes. So if we're interested in good government, they have to be adequately staffed, they have to be adequately compensated, they have to have good working conditions. And we can go through several other agencies, as you mentioned, and, you know, Reagan is very notable with the air traffic controllers because he attacked and broke that union when he was in office and probably laid the groundwork for the terrible working conditions that they have today. But yes, the federal government has just been shrinking, and agency after agency have workers who are stressed and fatigued, and that leads to high rates of attrition. You know, the wait for, I saw something, people trying to reach the IRS. Most of the calls to the IRS today are not being answered because they're understaffed. So that again is not good government. And of course, many millionaires and billionaires are getting away with cheating on their taxes because, again, the IRS is understaffed. And unfortunately, Republicans in Congress are again trying to cut that IRS funding. The Biden administration put an increase in, and the conservative Republicans are working their hardest to cut it back, which of course helps millionaires and billionaires cheat on taxes.
So there's no way for this kind of problem of lack of a workforce to be resolved on the federal level, because if you have, on the state level, I should say, because with some agency like the IRS, you know, it has to be federal, right? Are there areas where states could kind of compensate for the lack of federal support?
I think to some extent, but really, I think in very limited areas. Unfortunately, states generally have to balance their budget. And because, again, of sort of poor tax policy and maybe other problems, they are under more fiscal constraints than the federal government. And we know that in state government, unfortunately, state and local government, there's significant understaffing. You know, the teachers, we should be investing a lot more in our educational system, for example, and that's primarily under state control. So I think there are some areas where states can help, but, you know, we have a federal government for a reason. So in the area of banking, taking care of veterans, the IRS, we mentioned other areas, we really need the federal government, and states can help. But they can only help if they have, you know, the financial resources available to them now.
You think this cutting off of resources will lead to people just taking things into their own hands, and through their own community efforts, through their own volunteer efforts, they'll create their own kind of support systems. I'm thinking of something like, you know, the Black Panther free breakfast programs, you know, this idea that we can't rely on those people, so we have to do it ourselves.
You know, if you have to feed your family, you're going to try everything you can to feed your family. So people will try everything they can, and communities will try everything they can. But there's a real question about how scalable those things are. So, you know, one of the areas that the Trump-Musk administration is cutting is like Head Start staff. And, you know, many...
That was something that even Republicans supported in the past, right?
Yeah, I mean, many of the things, you know, used to be bipartisan and are no longer. And yeah, I mean, many people rely on Head Start for, you know, not just the children's education, but as childcare. So losing that would place a significant burden on families and communities. And maybe people will be able to kind of find an alternative, but we have to recognize that it will be a significant burden for the people who already have few resources. And, you know, another area I was just reading about is our national parks and the loss of staffing in the national parks. You know, many people, particularly during the summer, utilize the national parks for vacations, recreation, etc. But now, with the staffing cuts, there are going to be much longer lines and much more difficulties. Bathrooms may be out of service, or if they are working, they may be unclean. So that is